I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are about to have a conversation with Leslie Marmon Silko. Her latest book is a memoir called The Turquoise Ledge. Of course, she reached national fame with her writing with her book 30 years ago, I think it was, called Ceremony. Almanac of the Dead, of course, is another one of her great books, Garden in the Dunes. She's a MacArthur Fellow. Many things we could say about her, but she's living in Tucson, Arizona, and was kind enough to go to KUAZ in Tucson, Arizona, to join us here with a conversation. And Leslie, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
This is great. I was thinking as we were starting this, every time I read something about you or people write about you, they go, Leslie Marmon Silko, one of the great Native American writers in America. And every time I read that, I go, I wonder if Leslie Marmon Silko is just tired of that title. That can't you just be one of the great writers in America?
Yeah, that's what I say.
I mean, we have this tendency to kind of categorize and say, this is, if you're not white in America, then you have to be the greatest whatever you are.
Exactly, but they never say so-and-so is the great white male American.
They don't. I mean, so do you ever get into conversations with people about that when they say that?
Usually I just let it sort of slide by, because the Modern Languages Association and all of these different professional organizations in English literature also ghettoize or categorize literature in that way. And so you can hardly blame other people outside the academy for doing what these other people do. And then you have the marketeers at the publishers trying to find their target audience so they can market the book. So I usually don't say anything about it.
Well, I wanted to bring it up anyway. So I thought.
No, thank you for bringing it up, because it is the one time where I really sort of felt badly about it was I got some writer's award from the University of Texas at San Marcos. And that's what it said, great Native American writer. And I thought, yeah, couldn't it just be American writer, you know, after all this time?
Maybe we're getting there, because I think there was one part in your book where you talk about if I say this incorrectly, please correct my language. Is it Nahuatl language?
Nahuatl.
Nahuatl, Nahuatl. The Nahuatl language, you said that the Aztec spoke is also the Hopi language, and you talked about that in terms of the people coming from the south to the north now, and saying New Mexico and Arizona are much theirs as anybody else's, because they've been there. This always was part of their homeland, and it gave me the sense that when we talk about the future of America, that this is the future of America.
It really is the future of America, and the people from the South bring with them a kind of humanity and kindness that really is of the Americas, and there's a generosity of spirit, and so I that we need desperately up here, and so I look at the migration, which is just a part of a series of migrations that have gone on for thousands of years. I look upon that as an important and positive part of our destiny here in the United States.
When in this book, when I wrote you the other night, I was thinking about I didn't know what to expect when I started reading the book. I knew it was a memoir. I didn't know what that meant. It made reading something different to every writer. But then when you spend a huge, huge portion of the book talking about your relationship to rattlesnakes.
Yes.
That I was not expecting that at all. That was the last thing that I thought I would be reading about.
Well, I'm like you. I don't know what memoir means. I mean, I know that oftentimes someone says, now I'm going to go write my memoirs, and then they wink wickedly, or we poke fun at memoirs. And I'm not a great fan of memoirs. I mean, I'm not sure what that genre really is supposed to be. So I decided I would make my own sort of stab at write, you know, making the memoir be mine. And I wanted it to be, I wanted it to give people an idea about my internal consciousness and what really matters to me or keeps my attention. And so, of course, rattlesnakes are right at the top of the list.
But this is, it's more than just rattlesnakes. I mean, and I didn't think I was going to start here, but we're here. So the love you have for these snakes and the respect you have for these snakes, because these are things we're taught to fear. These are things
yes.
that are poisonous. They're going to bite us. They're going to kill us. They're going to kill our children. They need to be shot, moved out of the yard, get out of wherever human beings live, because they're dangerous to us. And that's how we see them.
Right. But it's so, it's such an incomplete view that has been manufactured. And some of it goes back to just Christianity and the Garden of Eden story of the evil snake. But then it goes farther just with the kind of hysteria born of ignorance. And I was very cautious of snakes. You know, when I think I even say in my memoir, my father was a snake killer.
A snake killer, right.
But then after I had a chance, for more than 30 years, I've lived in very close contact with them, the snake under my kitchen floor. I learned that they're really not as they're portrayed at all, and the very last way that they'll take when they're confronted, when they only strike or try to bite when they think they're going to die, and the rest of the time they're very forgiving of us humans. And I've stepped on more than once, stepped on a snake. I've touched them. In situations where I deserve to be bitten because of my carelessness, and they didn't bite me.
Mm-hmm. In the book, as I was reading, I was waiting to turn the page to find the day when you were bitten by the snake.
Oh, no.
But it didn't happen.
Well, no, it's a form of discipline now that I tell myself when I go out there with all my friends that you have to pay attention and you know, keep your eyes open. I got bitten by one of my friends, the bees, day before yesterday because I picked up the hose. And, of course, bees being considerably smaller than rattlesnakes, I sometimes have accidents with bees. And I picked up the hose and I crushed one. And before it died, it bit me. And I was thinking to myself, I'm glad the rattlesnakes aren't as tiny as bees. Then we would be in a lot more trouble, I think.
But there are some small rattlesnakes.
Yes, and I worry about that. The babies, they're so tiny. They're just the diameter of a piece of spaghetti. And you could theoretically barefooted or in your thongs, you know, come in contact with a little tiny rattlesnake. And so That's crossed my mind that I have to be careful, very careful about the babies. Fortunately, they're only tiny for a short while, and that's usually in September, August or September. So I'm just extra careful then.
The words you used a moment ago, and it'd be interesting to explore because it's the nature of the relationship you have with whether it's the hummingbirds or that you write about, or the ants, or the bees, or the rattlesnakes, or your pit bulls and mastiffs, or whatever is around you, the macaws, you refer to the bee as your friend.
Yes, because that's one of the important lessons I think that we humans can get from wild things and nature. The inherent peacefulness and tolerance that all other living beings have towards one another and towards us. And it seems as if only humans, and then only some humans, are so warlike and intolerant. And actually that all living things, we are all friends. And, you know, in the very, very beginning, we all came out of the same soup of stars and galaxies. And so I like to look way, way back and see that really we initially all started out from one substance.
Speaking of that, one of the things I was really taken by in this book, and I was reading, I was home reading the book, and I kept talking about it as I was reading, and the other half of my existence at home, Valerie would kept saying, you know, hurry up and finish. I want to read this book.
But, wonderful.
So I kept, but I, what I was saying was marveling at was, and really penetrated, I think, to, for people to read and discuss, is the way you meld and weave the love of science, the sense of understanding of the spirit and the spirit world, and the land itself, and how they come together. Because you, when you write about whether it's the rocks or the snakes, and talk about them in as an understanding the geological formations and understanding the, where things come from, but that's not a disconnect nor something separate from the understanding of the spirit world or relationship to them. You see them all as one.
Yes, I think that's something that I didn't consciously plan in writing the book, but I'm really happy that's how it came together and that's what's emerged, because I think it's terribly important in our dialogue with other humans and just our existence in the world that we begin to see that there aren't these barriers and these borders, but really all of these things complement one another.
So when you did you spend a lot of time studying the science of the earth? You write a lot about geological formations and cloud formations and the science of them.
Well, just for years, I'm an omnivorous reader, and as I got older, I became more interested in astronomy and science and geology. I just became more interested, and I'm a sort of self-educated in the sciences. I'm afraid in the Bureau of Indian Affairs school that I attended as a little child was very weak in math and science, and so I don't have anything but a layperson's ability to read a lot that's published. But I decided I would read it like poetry. You know, mm-hmm. You don't have to understand every single word of a poem, and that's how I started reading some of the books on astrophysics or geology.
You begin the book, you don't spend a lot of time in the book worrying or talking about people.
No. I was tired of people.
Which is why you live where you live at the moment.
Exactly. I learned to value solitude over the years, writing Almanac of the Dead for 10 years, nearly every day, I would go into a room for 6 or 7 hours and just be with my characters, and I crossed a dangerous line. In fact, that was when I decided I had to wrap up that novel. My characters had more reality and were more delightful than actual human beings, which, of course, you want your fictional characters to be very engaging. But something after Almanac of the Dead found me in a different place as far as solitude, and I really crave it and value it.
It's clear. You start the book, the people that you focus on, and there are only a few that run through the book. They pop up every once in a while, but it's in the beginning when you talk about your family and where you come from,
right?
Your lineage, your heritage, this multicultural, white Indian mixed world that you come from.
Right.
And that, I guess part of the process sounded as if you were also, we all do, I guess, work through what that has meant, work through what we have to work through to find out who we are out of that morass of whether it was the whipping grandmother or the kindly grandmother.
Exactly. And I think, too, you can look at when I was a child, the reason I gravitated more towards animals and being alone was probably to get out of that sort of atmosphere that was sometimes there between the, you know, different parts of the family and the sort of subtle clashes between cultures. I found that the wild things and being out in the hills with the rocks, a great relief from the little tensions and the little misunderstandings among humans. So I think that part of my coming to terms with that was turning towards nature and spending lots of time alone in the hills.
When you wrote about the grandmother the one grandmother you had who came from a line of people who whipped their children and whipped their Indian slaves, and you wrote a lot about that in the beginning of the book.
Right.
And I thought about that kind of violence. And you talked about how the other part of your family, that violence towards children was not part of a tradition.
Right.
They didn't do that. And I want you to ask this question. Was a friend of mine once, who I've not seen in years, but I know she's in Albuquerque now and a doctor, and she's Jicarilla.
Uh-huh.
Her family, she's Jicarilla. And years ago when I talked to her, she said to me, we were talking about how she lost the family sheep because this crazy white woman came out with a whip and she and her brother lost all the sheep and it was her family's money for a year and she went home without anything. And I asked if her parents got mad, did they get, you know, did they spank her, whatever happened. And she looked at me and she said, the Jicarilla don't spank their children because you don't hit the light of God and we see children as the light of God.
Wow.
And I said, whoa. That made me sit down. And as you were writing, I was thinking of that particular story that happened to me with her about the different way we look at children and the nature of violence and who we do violence towards.
Exactly. And I found that in just recently in talking with a wonderful poet from one of the California mission tribes, Deborah Miranda, and she's been researching, going through the archives of old newspapers in California to find out what they reported about mission Indians. And she went farther. She went into the reports of the Spanish priests who were in charge of the missions and the mission Indians in California. And in the very early reports, there were six questions that the priests had to respond to once a year and send to the archbishop. And one of them was, if I can phrase it the way it was, are your Indians disciplining their children? And what she found in her research is the first 10 to 15 years that the missions were established and the priests were there, the priests would respond, oh, no, we have to whip their children. They love their children. They treat them like little idols, meaning I guess they practically worship their children. We have to whip their children. And then another 10 or 15 years passes, and the reports say to that question, well, they still can't bring themselves to whip their children, but they bring their children to us for us to whip. And then another 20 or 30 years goes by, and Deborah said, when you read the reports, the priests write, the parents are whipping their children and, you know, and using stern discipline with their children. And so you can trace the introduction of violence against children through the Catholic Church. And then, of course, the Indian boarding schools, which is where a lot of the violence towards children, you know, Indian children were taken away from their families when they were very young. And then they were dealt with very harshly. And so they left those schools with a different idea of how children were treated, unfortunately.
And you experienced that in a sense as a child growing up because you had your feet in so many worlds.
Yes.
And you sound as if in some ways as a child you retreated into your own world of solitude even as a young girl.
Yes, I did, and I think it was because of the strictness and what I write about. That of course my father was a product of that kind of, you know, whippings and violence towards children, and of course he did it thinking that that's what one did, but it was quite devastating for us children.
And how did that translate? This is maybe none of my business. You can tell me to shut up. But how did that translate into you and your own children?
Well, I got the idea that if I was just a screamer, that was better than someone who struck the children. It's taken a while, of course, to begin to be horrified at what I thought was good parenting. And, you know, I guess we sort of just have to, if we cut slack for ourselves, I suppose we have to have a little forgiveness too for the parents who think that they're doing the right thing, you know, because that's what was done to them. But we've got to somehow break that chain. So I'm proud to say that my elder son, who is just here visiting with his daughter, is a very wonderful parent and doesn't even raise his voice and is still firm and loving but there's no violence, and so I'm greatly relieved. He's not a screamer like I was.
See, they survived despite us.
Yes, they do. Thank goodness.
We're talking with Leslie Marmon Silko. Her latest book is a memoir called "The Turquoise Ledge." One of our great writers lives in Arizona now, in Tucson. One of the things in this book, and I want to go through some of the stuff that really is in the book, since I'm diverting too much here away from the book, but is coming back to the crotalus, the rattlesnakes.
Yes.
And I mean, you not only were in the house, but there was one after a series of young rattlesnakes were killed by, I remember it was one. Was it your father, your relative? They came in, they were worried about the snakes they saw, they killed them, but your son always wanted a pet rattlesnake and saved one, and he became the pet of your house.
Yes, and he's still there.
Evo, right?
Evo. He's 24 years old.
Wow.
Yep.
So, I mean, that's something most people don't have. I mean, I was a kid, I told you when I wrote you an email, I had all these boa constrictors and other snakes, but I never had a rattlesnake.
Well, I'm very respectful of reticulate pythons. They may not be poisonous, but there are some snakes, especially if it's large, that can still get a hold of you and squeeze you to death.
Oh, yes.
But the rattlers, I think part of my affection for them is because they're killed so unfairly, and they're I can't stand it. A while back, NPR did an interview with someone from one of those terrible rattlesnake roundups in Texas.
Oh, yes.
Where they round up all the snakes and slaughter them, and didn't even ask one harsh question to that person, you know, about this practice. But the thing that fascinates me, too, about all reptiles is the possibility that their brains are like gray parrot brains and bird brains. They may be small in volume, but they're more like digital, organized in a digital way, that these reptiles are much more intelligent than researchers even know yet, but that someday we will have much more regard for them than we do now.
I mean, that's a part of it, isn't it? I mean, a part of it is that we as human beings, and that's the sense I got from your book, is that we don't understand or regard the intelligences of the other creatures around us. And what they may not be like our intelligence, but they know what's going on. You talk about how they recognize you in your yard. All these dozens of rattlers live around your house. They've come to know that you're part of their environment, as you put it. And they know who you are. They don't get upset when they walk around.
No, they don't. And there have been other instances, too. Evo, the indoor rattlesnake, this was many years ago. I have a friend who does videos, Victor Macias from Haute Villa, Hopi. And he wanted to come. He said, I want to come film your rattlesnake for a video that I'm doing. And I told him, well, my rattlesnake just sits there, you know. But you're welcome to come, you know, photograph him. And Mark, you wouldn't believe it. As soon as the camera was set up and my friends started recording, That snake did all sorts of graceful, sinuous moves, and it was as if he was performing for Victor, and sort of made a liar out of me because I said, oh, the snake won't do anything. And the snake seemed to be playing to the camera. I thought that was the strangest thing. So even in situations, brand new situations, I've seen the rattlesnakes betray some further knowledge of what's going on, it seems.
You write about, and I'll tell you, just share this with everybody, and again, if I say it wrong, you'll correct me, Ahuacan.
Ahuacan, yes.
The cult of Ahuacan, and how you discovered that, and you're calling yourself in that one part of your book a Crotalus-centric believer your whole life.
Yes. The Mayan people, of course, had a high regard for the rattlesnake and the giant serpent. And some years ago, my good friend Linda Neiman traveled down to Veracruz, and at one of the Mayan ruins, there was this eccentric poet who had come up with this Ahuacan religion and he was positing that, interestingly, it might be true that the way that the rattlesnake coils up is the way that the foundations of the pyramids that the Mayans and Aztecs built, that's the way that they did them. And he speculated that they had studied the way the rattlesnake coiled up and decided that was a very solid base for a structure. Anyway, I decided that I would continue with that cult almost of, in my own way, of giving high regard and thanks to the existence of rattlesnakes.
Earlier in the book, you read about the Crotalus gigantus, which is
yes.
a 12-foot rattler that the Europeans killed off.
Well, it's not. I was reading recently that they're not clear whether that should be a completely separate subspecies or whether there's an implication that maybe they're still here. They just never get to live long enough to get that big. So I'm most intrigued with the possibility that somewhere, some distant canyon, a box canyon far from people, there could still be some of these gigantic rattlers.
Well, now, when you wrote in your book, didn't you write, like I think it was around page 148, if I remember, after that, did you write into one? You saw what you thought was a 12-foot rattler when you were on one of your hikes?
Yes. And I'll never know whether that was just the... I mean, I discuss it in the book, whether it was the play of shadow, the formation of the rocks in that shadow, a shift of sunlight. But I'm always prepared to encounter one. I give the possibility, I've not given up on the possibility that I might be honored to meet one.
And if anybody will meet one and honored to do so, it'll be you. and when you talk about that, I mean, when you describe the land that you walk or used to ride on, again, it's with the sense of the land being alive, the land being something you honor. You don't talk a lot about the fights against development, but that one part of your book where you get really upset with one of your neighbors.
Yes.
Because of what they're doing to the land. I mean, your sense of that land around you, even though it's not where you grew up, is very deep, and you see it in a very kind of way of the spirit, not just of a piece of dirt and earth to be moved around.
Exactly. And I've even learned things just, in the past couple of years. After I broke my foot and was off the trail for about 7 weeks, when I went back on the trail, it felt so welcoming. The earth almost on the trail almost felt like it was sort of softening between me and my broken foot, and I felt welcomed back. And there's also a steep hill on my walk. And usually I walk down the hill, but a few times I've turned around and walked up, and sometimes it almost feels as if the hill helps me go up, helps me walk up it. It's a strange feeling of positive energy that I did not expect to find, and am still sort of amazed even as I talk about it, but that there's that kind of closeness that one can feel with the earth through your feet and through the way you can move up a steep hill. That's available to us as human beings. We just kind of have to open ourselves in a way that this society doesn't usually encourage.
We're talking with Leslie Marmon Silko. Her latest work is called The Turquoise Ledge, a memoir. Of course, she's known to all of us, all of you who have read her over the years, for Ceremony, the book she wrote 30 years ago that launched this career for America to read her work. She joins us from Tucson, Arizona. We'll take a short break and come right back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are talking this hour with Leslie Marmon Silko about her new work, The Turquoise Ledge, a memoir. And she joins us from our sister station out in Arizona, in Tucson, Arizona, KUAZ. Picking up where we left off, this memoir, I want some pieces I want to talk about here that I think that some people, when they read this book, I mean, for me, it made me have some strange dreams.
Good.
It was really weird. I'll tell you about that in a little bit. I mean, I woke up the other morning and I told Valerie, I said, you know, I'm having a lot of weird dreams here lately. And what is this? And I realized I think it was the book.
That makes me happy.
That did this to me. You write about star beings. And
yes.
This can be just disconcerting to a lot of people who read the book, I think, especially if you read it with kind of an urbane sensibility. Do you know what I'm saying? Just be able to
yes.
say that. And I was really taken by that. Talk a bit about these star beings. Introduce our world to that.
Well, I made the decision to include that because I really was wanting to share with readers my sort of inner workings of my mind and imagination and so forth. And so this is, I would say, the part of my memoir where I decided to just go ahead and drift over into the area of fiction. Not that my perception of the star beings or their realism for me is a fiction. It's very real, but I understand that for some, they will have to read it as if it's a product of my fictional imagination. But it happened in late 2005, as I describe in the book. I decided I would take time off from writing. That is, even forbid myself to work on writing and just concentrate on painting. And I didn't, of course, the first problem was when I decided to paint, what would I paint? And so I thumbed through some different things. And then I realized that I wanted to work with petroglyphs and old pictographs that I had seen on sandstone, things that had been made hundreds, thousands of years before I came along as a child and saw them. And then I did more reading about a number of the figures because you often see a cross associated with them, and people who don't understand confuse the cross with the cross of Christianity. But in the Americas, in the Mayan and Aztec and other tribal lexicons, the cross is a sign for Venus, for the planet Venus, or for stars. And I began to see that many of these very strange figures that look like they're from another dimension or another galaxy had the stars on them. And then I realized that finally that they were the star beings. And they've played a very constant and kind of scary role over the thousands of years with their relationship with human beings and the tribal people. And so I began to, as I was painting, when you paint, your mind sort of, you're focused on the paintbrush and trying to get the figure to come out. But there's a part of your mind that's free, closer to the subconscious. And as I was painting, I began to imagine that, or at first, I guess I began to try to imagine, well, what does this particular star being think of us human beings now, looking at what we humans have done to one another and to animals and to the earth? And I began with the different star beings to have these silent dialogues. And then I began to think, well, you know, this is probably how they would communicate with a human. They would inveigle their way into one's thoughts and imaginings. And so I kind of went with it. And that's how I started writing about the star beings. And I recorded, after I would finish painting, I would record these imaginary conversations that I had with them. So that's how I got involved with the star beings. And one reviewer did remark that they found it strange, that the one strange thing that Silco does is her star beings.
Lock her up now. Take her away.
Yep.
but it's when you wrote about them and you talked about, well, two things came to my mind as you were talking. One was that you wrote about the idea of where things may come from we don't understand, like parallel universes, which is
right. Something
that physicists now and mathematicians write about, the notion
Correct.
Of parallel universes and how they could exist, and this thin membrane that may exist that things can pass through, like Robert Pullman writes about in his books. You know, that's interesting. Again, this is this bridge you make between science and the spirit world.
Well, when I first started reading about particle physics, as I say, I have to read what's written for the layperson. I can't read what's written for trained scientists. But many of the concepts, the idea that at the subatomic level, the words past, present, and future are kind of irrelevant. Everything is sort of present. I immediately became intrigued because I recognized a lot of the views of the indigenous people and the Pueblo people as being closer to that of the realm of particle physics than it was to Newtonian physics. And so I began to look back at many of the kinds of experiences that are related in the old stories, and even in the Hamaha stories, the little Laguna Pueblo, well, all the tribes have them, animal stories. Sometimes at the beginning of the story, say Buffalo Man was actually a human being, and then later in the story, he puts the young woman on his back and gallops away. So obviously he's transformed almost effortlessly into a buffalo, and then he can go back to being a human. And that's where these parallel universes and these different dimensions, you begin to think that's where you can see them in the stories, that fluidity of reality and not just feeling that we're stuck in a single time or a single place. That was the connection that I began to make between what they've discovered with the behavior of subatomic particles and what I found in the worldview of the old-time Pueblo people, where their world was many-layered and many parallels and turns and steps. And not just the Pueblo people, but a lot of the indigenous cultures around the world
right.
have a much more rich and diverse vision of what reality is.
And see, what you're doing, the way you write this book, to what you were just, I think what you're describing now, Leslie, is really critically important, because it takes these ideas, the Homo historicism that you wrote about, that you kind of were denied a little bit as a child by one part of your family,
right.
but that you, what you're doing is taking these stories and you're taking them out of the realm of just pure mythology and talking about how they are on the basis of our reality.
Right.
And that's something for us to wrestle with that we don't do.
Well, we're still living in a world where most of us, we operate every day on what was known around the time of Sir Isaac Newton. It takes a very, very long time for the discoveries, especially discoveries that are so radical in terms of the reality we know. It takes a very long time for them to enter into human culture. And so my belief is that someday all of this will be old hat, these things that I'm writing about and these things that we're discussing. But that was one of the things I was hoping to do, was to try to show that these so-called radical, strange discoveries by the particle physicists are really not that far from the world that we live in, and that you can experience them in a real way in your own life, if you'll just open yourself up to that possibility.
One of the things you mentioned a moment ago is that when you get to the subatomic particle level, the notion of time is different, and you spend different parts of the book, especially in the beginning, talking about your grandparents, your grandmother, especially this one grandmother, where time was different. The concept for the Laguna Pueblo and many other Native people in the older traditions, older way, time doesn't mean the same thing. Time is different.
Exactly. That was my great-grandmother, the one I call Grandma Amu. My great-grandmother never knew what year she was born. She didn't know what month or day. Those things were irrelevant to the old-time people, as I call them. And I think in a lot of indigenous groups this was true. And there was no concern about clocks or calendars. There was always plenty of time. My great-grandma always had time to talk to me and to my little sisters. And you never heard or felt the old folks become impatient or get in a hurry. And they for them, it was the present moment. And only perhaps if you needed daylight would they glance up and say, "Well, we need to finish this fairly soon because we're running out of daylight." But it was never the clock demanding anything or the calendar. And everyone understood that when they said they would come visit in a few days, that it might be a few days or it might be a week, but that was understood. And it was a very different experience than to suddenly go to first grade and to have these strict deadlines and times when we humans had to stop. Why? Because of the little hands on the clock. It was very strange as a child to see the difference between those two worlds, the world that was free of clocks and calendars, and then this world that where a clock could tell adult human beings that they had to stop or they had to go. I can still remember my wonderment at these two different ways. And I find as I get older that I'm Well, my whole life I've been pretty resentful of clocks and calendars. And and as I get older, I get even more resentful.
I understand that. I always call myself calendrically challenged.
Yes.
I hate them. But another piece of this that really strikes me, and I'm kind of moving through these so that our listeners can get a sense of the book so they can read it themselves, is that is when you talk about language, and I'm going to say it wrong again.
Nahuatl.
The Nahuatl and the Hopi language being similar is one thing you talk about. You also talk about when you write about the language, when you talk about words in the language and what they mean. And it's clear that, you know, language defines a people's philosophical view and is defined by it at the same time, the way we speak, the way we form words.
Right.
And it was very clear in terms of when you talk about these languages.
Yes.
That you were denied.
Well, what I've tried to do, I guess, is it's true that those languages were denied to me by the draconian measures that were taken in school, you know, the punishment, corporal punishment for speaking the language. But early on, I decided, or I didn't decide, but I got to thinking about the English that I grew up speaking, and I realized that the English that I speak and my sense of the use of English was very much informed and formed by these wonderful people who did not speak English as a first language, but as a second language. And so I, in my own way, I've decided that I have a very subtle influence of the Laguna, the Carrizan, or the Laguna Kawakame, that language, which gets expressed very indirectly through my sense of spoken English, which I learned from them, and their way of using English and their delight in English was directly related to their first experience, which of course was in the Carrizan language. So I rationalized that I might not have the primary influence of the indigenous language, the Laguna language, but I have this more subtle influence in through the way that English was absorbed by and then later used by them. Like Aunt Susie, there were certain words that she really loved in English. Precipitous was one of the words that she used. And that has to be because that word precipitous and what it means in English also had a wonderful sound and resonance in her mind as a Carrizan speaker, a Laguna Pueblo language speaker.
Didn't have a B.
It didn't have a B. Yes, Nahuatl not having the B's. Yes.
So the one of the things you read about also that was struck me when I was talking about before I left home was when you talked about the Hopi holy men who went to Mexico City.
Yes.
During the drought. That was a pretty amazing story. Would you mind telling that story?
I wouldn't mind at all. I heard it in when I went down to Ciudad Chihuahua, because this was where the Hopis from northern Arizona, they didn't speak Spanish. So in Ciudad Chihuahua, when they got down that far, they picked up interpreters. But this is how it went. The people up at Second Mesa, the old followers of the old religion, noted that we were in a terrible drought. The whole southwestern United States was in a terrible drought. This is in 2006. And so they recalled that the Hopis had this method of going in during really terrible droughts, that they would make this sacred run, and they would have to run from Haute Villa up in northern Arizona all the way to Mexico City. And during the day they would run, and then, of course, at night they would rest. But there was a ritual path that they had to follow, and this ritual path took them to springs, water holes, little creeks along the way, all the way from northern Arizona, just think of it, all the way to Mexico City. And so how they did it was this. They had young men who were a part of their religious group. The young men trotted along the highways or the shoulders of the highway and other trails by day. And then at night, the old priests who were riding along in the van would be there, and they would camp. And at each of these watering spots, they would gather in a canteen, a gourd canteen. They would gather just a little bit of water from each of these sacred stopping places. And so, of course, it took them weeks to get to Mexico City. And they stopped in Ciudad Chihuahua and picked up interpreters, and they continued on. And then the place they were bringing it to was the huge monolithic stone statue of Tlaloc, who is the Nahua god of rain. And the Hopis at that point outside the Anthropology Museum in Mexico City were to pray at the statue of Tlaloc and pour a little bit of that water they'd gathered. And then there were two little rivers that also intersect nearby the statue. And they also put some water there. And the old priests said prayers, basically asking Tlaloc to send the clouds, rain clouds and snow clouds north. And the most moving part of the story, as it was told to me by these individuals from Ciudad Chihuahua, was that in the middle, here they are in downtown Mexico City, and these are Mexican people telling me, and it's very polluted. Oh, you know, the sky is covered with pollution. It's a very polluted place. And when the priest, the Hopi priest, got done pouring the water and praying, dropping down out of the cloudy, overcast, polluted sky of Mexico City came an eagle. An eagle circled them and screamed as it circled above them. And these guys from Mexico, Ciudad Chihuahua, were just blown away. They couldn't believe that an eagle would even be in the Mexico City polluted air, much less come down and circle around right at the moment that the Hopi prayers were finished. But they've Victor Masayasva has it on videotape. So there's proof that this eagle did come and circle right at that moment, and so they were amazed. But the even more amazing thing that happened was that by the end of March into June, we had all these wonderful rainstorms. And then, of course, that winter, heavy snow in Albuquerque and Denver. So not only did the eagle come out and accept the blessing there in Mexico City, but better yet, we got all this wonderful rain and snow sent to us thanks to the prayers and efforts of the Hopi runners who went and begged Tlaloc to send us rain.
For me, that's a wonderful way to end this particular interview, that story. Leslie Marmon-Silko of the Turquoise Ledge, thank you so much. It's just been a pleasure to have you on the air with us.
Thank you so much, Mark.
And I also want to thank Matt Felix over there at KUAZ for engineering on their side. And I hope we can do this again.
I hope so, too.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.